This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here this week with Susan and a special guest. First, hello, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
How you doing?
I'm okay. Rough news week.
Rough news week, yeah. Well, speaking of rough news week, we are dedicating the majority of this show to the tragic events that unfolded this past weekend in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And we have a very special guest on who I'm very thankful for being here. Joining us today is Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan is both a friend and he's also the CEO of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. He is the sixth national director. Before joining the ADL, Jonathan served in the White House as special assistant to President Obama and director of the Office of Social Innovation and Civic Participation. So Jonathan, first of all, thank you for coming on to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you before we get into kind of what happened this weekend and everything your community is dealing with, you know, how are you? How's your staff? And what kind of pieces are moving in the last few days? Like, what has this animated?
Well, I mean, I think there are a few things, Robbie. So first of all, I think that it's really a privilege for me to be have the opportunity to talk to you about this. These have been, for me, having been on the job, as you kind of alluded to, only a few years, because I was in public service before this, in the private sector most of my life. These 3 days have certainly been the most trying and the most challenging since I took this job. You know, we've seen this kind of thing in places like Europe, certainly in Israel, and you've seen different kinds of violence. But what I hadn't seen before, what I wouldn't have imagined before, was that one of those scenes would play out at a synagogue here in America. Frankly, you know, my worst, the thing that's kept me up at night, the thing that I worry about, if you will, was the idea that I would wake up one morning to hear about a massacre at a Jewish institution in Europe, or a massive terrorist event in Israel. But particularly in Europe, where anti-Semitism is quite prevalent, and it's been quite dangerous and had a real high human toll in recent years, because there have been, you know, attacks and murders in places like France, in Belgium, in Germany, Sweden. Against that backdrop, I wondered, could that ever happen? And when it happened, would I say, you know, have I done enough? Well, I wouldn't have imagined I would wake up one morning and the issue wouldn't be over there, it would be here at home. And it wouldn't be in some sort of abstract, hypothetical place. It would actually be in a physical sanctuary where elderly people were gunned down in the pews. I mean, the level of depravity to go into a house of worship, you know, and turn it into a place of slaughter is really unspeakable.
Yeah. You mentioned right now the very prevalent anti-Semitism in Europe, but the ADL focuses its work and on anti-Semitism in the United States, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about the ADL, people who might not be familiar with the organization and what it is?
So the ADL was founded in 1913, around the time in the United States when a Jewish man was lynched. By way of background, this man, Leo Frank, was from the from New York. He went down to Georgia to manage a family business. And it was a time of widespread anti-Semitism. Jews couldn't attend many universities. Jews were restricted from living in many, many places by restrictive housing covenants. Jews would not be hired in many professions. Jews were not admitted to many restaurants or hotels. And there was widespread anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish bias in the media. And so in that moment, this man went down to manage a family business. A young girl, a young Christian girl, was found sexually assaulted and strangled to death on the property. And instantly, they accused the Jew, Leo Frank, of having committed this crime. Now, he clearly had not done it. Nonetheless, there was something of a sham trial. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to death. He didn't have due process, and it was clearly an egregious injustice. So the governor intervened, the governor of Georgia, and commuted his sentence from the death penalty to life imprisonment. And the mob was so enraged by that act of leniency, they tore Leo Frank from his jail cell and they hung him from a tree.
Wow.
And they barbecued and they took pictures and they gave out those postcards that they created from those pictures as souvenirs. So in this moment, the ADL was formed. It actually was coming together a few years before when all this played out, and this really galvanized this organization. And the founders, they wrote a charter for this new organization, like a long document, like a manifesto of sorts. And in it, you can find the words that they used as what we would call today our mission statement. In fact, we do call it our mission statement. These are words that have never changed in 105 years. They wrote that their organization's purpose would be to, quote, stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment to all. Now, what's pretty remarkable about that, as I was saying a moment ago, 100 plus years ago, the Jews in the United States did not have, I don't know, a political standing or a cultural capital or economic resources or any of those things that we actually do have today. In fact, this community was small. It was weak, and their future was uncertain. And so what was remarkable was not so much that these people finally stood up and said, we're going to defend ourselves, because that they clearly needed to do, but it was that they also said, we will also defend others. Mm. You know, we will also seek justice and fair treatment to all. And their theory of change, if you will, was that when America would be good for all, for its Jews, it would also be good for all of its minorities. And when it was good for all of its minorities, it would also be good for its Jews. And that duality, it was a bold and audacious thing that they would be able to fight for others successfully, let alone themselves. But that has animated the organization for over 100 years. So when the guy who had my job in 1952 filed an amicus brief in Brown v. Board of Education, it was because the ADL was committed to justice for treatment to all. And when the ADL... when he stood then 12 years later in the Rose Garden, when they signed the Civil Rights Act, it was because ADL was committed to justice and fair treatment to all. And when, again, my predecessors stood up for marriage equality or fought for the gender, for the Violence Against Women Act and issues of gender equity, or in 1957, when concerned about rising xenophobia in the United States, the head of the ADL engaged a young politician, the junior senator from Massachusetts, and said, would you write a book to make the point that we are a country of refugees and a nation of immigrants? And the book that young junior senator, his name was John Kennedy, the book mm-hmm. that he wrote, A Nation of Immigrants, was only the second book that he wrote in his career. The first one, of course, was Profiles in Courage. It was published in 1958, and Rabia, literally last week, on October 16th, we published the 60th anniversary of that book.
You know, and what? You also sent me a copy of it, so thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
I wrote a new foreword, and John Kennedy's grand nephew, Joe Kennedy, who's a member of Congress, he wrote an introduction. Otherwise, the book is exactly as it was published in 1958. And what's so remarkable is that we're still facing these issues. So when I speak out for Muslim refugees, you know, escaping the horror of the Syrian civil war, and when I speak out against the notion of separating children from their families, those people who are seeking asylum here, and when I speak out against the disgusting nativist, xenophobic claims that there's some caravan, you know, hurtling upon us, threatening to overwhelm this country, I do it because we were once strangers too.
Right.
And so
the ADL
can build walls, but you are better off locking arms. That's how we protect ourselves as a Jewish community. That's how we protect other marginalized communities.
And that is in part motivated the attack here. It was not just, it was anti-Semitic in part because of Jewish support for refugees. It was a combination of fact. Like that same support you're talking about for all persecuted groups is what sent this guy over the edge, apparently.
This guy,
Caravan conspiracy theory.
Yeah, this disgusting person. He ranted about that. He ranted about the fact that Hayes, This is the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, the same organization that settled my wife, who came here as a political refugee, advocates for immigrants. And in fact, I myself, as the ADL CEO, led a trip to the border this summer with the highest CEO. And we visited with people on both sides of the border who are part of this entire kind of immigration issue and this refugee crisis. And the whatever you call him, I don't know, the suspect, the shooter.
The murderer, the terrorist. I have a lot of words for him. Suspect is like not fair to me.
Yeah, the murderer, he retweeted charges that ADL, along with Hayes, was like seeking white genocide or whatever. I mean, right. I think here's the thing, though, Susan and Robbie, and for all of your listeners to hear, anti-Semites and bigots and racists will always find excuses for their intolerance. Their irrationality can never be rationalized. And we just need to recognize that what we need more than anything is for our leaders to lead and to call out this kind of hate before it happens and metastasizes into the kind of heinous act we saw happen this past weekend.
Susan, are you a savvy investor?
I don't know if I would use that word, savvy necessarily, but I would like to be.
Okay. You'd like to be. Well, I am absolutely not a savvy investor. In fact, the whole world of investments and all this stuff, like, it's always been too complicated for me, but it has been totally simplified because of the Robinhood app. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, cryptos, all kinds of things commission-free. Robinhood strives to make financial services work for everybody, not just the wealthy. So it works for us.
It's the way investment trading should have been all along. And I'm kind of wondering why it wasn't before now.
Right. You know why? Because they were barriers. I mean, you've got to have gatekeepers, but no more gatekeepers. Robinhood is a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers like me to invest for the first time with true confidence. And the app is so easy to use. It's simple. It's intuitive. Real clear design.
There's no like, oh, you don't want to invest in something that's going to pay in fees. No, it's about as simple as you possibly imagine.
Right. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every single trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Kind of crazy. Trade stocks and you keep all of your profits.
I actually kind of wonder how they're making a business, but because it's that easy.
How do you make money? Well, here's the thing. I don't know how they make money, but I'm happy they're giving us the opportunity to do so. And you, like me, again, a newcomer, can learn by just doing this. You learn how to invest as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks. I get these little notifications from Robinhood about like stocks going up, down, and different things happening in the world. And it's like, I'm just learning all these new things.
And Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at the45th.robinhood.com. That's the45th.robinhood.com.
So, Jonathan, I want to ask you, as part of your efforts with the ADL since you've come on board in the last couple of years, you made identifying and countering the threat of cyber hate like a priority for your organization. And the ADL has been fighting hate and bigotry for over 100 years, as you said before. Where are we today? What is the state of hate right now in the United States, online, in real life, hate crimes? What is the trajectory? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? What's happening?
Well, it depends on how we measure it, right? And there are sort of arguments about that. If we want to talk about what's happening offline, there are a couple different indices we might consider. So number one, you have overall hate crimes. So the FBI, whose data lags about a year, reported last year in 2017 that hate crimes are up 5% nationwide in 2016, including a 19% spike in crimes against Muslims and, you know, Muslim institutions, including a rise in crimes against Jews, against African-Americans and other groups. Our data tells us that anti-Semitic incidents, which includes not only, quote unquote, crimes, like, you know, misdemeanors and felonies, we track those, like vandalism or violence. We also track harassment. We saw a 57% spike specifically in anti-Semitic incidents in 2017. So our data is a year later, and we narrowly along lines of anti-Semitic, and more broadly, because we also include harassment. The spike was bigger last year than anything we've ever seen in 40 years of tracking this information. And then online, we've developed the means to start to really measure intolerance and hate on platforms. So we've done some analysis on places like Reddit, where it's alarming to see the amount of xenophobia and intolerance. And in fact, on Twitter, we saw in 2016, in the run-up to the election, a disturbing trend that we identified as being generated by the quote-unquote alt-right. And we have the distinction or dubious distinction to identify this group, this movement of white supremacists and other kind of haters. We saw a surge of anti-Semitic content directed at journalists in the run-up in 2016. Wouldn't you know, we did another analysis earlier this year. Through our center in Silicon Valley, we now have a research unit in the Valley, and we found an equally alarming and increasingly, you know, large spike in anti-Semitic abuse directed at candidates for elected office and Jewish journalists. And it's staggering stuff, Robbie, and it's worth noting about a third of it, a little less than a third, came from bots. Hmm. And more than two-thirds came from actual human accounts.
Wow. A lot more than I would have guessed.
Yeah,
in general.
I am shocked.
Oh, it's not real. It's just some Russian trolls and their algorithms, but it's not. It's real people sending this stuff, which is what makes it so alarming.
Just in terms of volume, it's so much easier with a bot or to use like a network. So you'd expect in most cases it'd be more of that just because of how easy it is. There has to be a lot of organic content online for that to be the majority of it.
That's pretty ugly. Yep.
Okay, so, you know, you talk about like the online spaces where this is propagating and it's mostly populated with real people. This guy, this terrorist murderer, Bowers, he was operational on Gab. Gab, apparently, I hadn't even heard of it until now. It's like an online space that white supremacists love. I think it's just it recently was shut. Nazi Twitter. Oh, okay. Well, it's been apparently shut down, and it posted a statement saying Gab's under attack, blah, 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 you know, and that we've been smeared by the mainstream media for defending free expression and individual liberty. So I guess like my question is, how do we balance, you know, the right to free speech, which includes hate speech, with like this urgent need to shut down like these kinds of sites and platforms and accounts? Like, what is the right approach for tech companies? And I know you work a lot with tech companies, Jonathan.
We do. Like this center we opened last year, we need to engage the companies. They have an important role to play. Policy can't solve this problem alone. You know, we also need better products. And lawyers can't tackle this alone, or legislators. We also need engineers and computer scientists. Gab is a service that became a haven for white supremacists after many of the worst offenders were chased off large public platforms like Twitter and Facebook.
It used to be really bad to get kicked off Twitter. So
you did. I mean,
we're not talking low-level bad. We're talking like the ones that even Twitter can't find an excuse for.
Yeah, so you have to be pretty egregious. And indeed, what basically happened is that, you know, PayPal stopped providing them payment services. Their domain name hosting company stopped supporting them. I think their ISP went down too. So they had a bunch of different companies in the value chain that it takes to put up a website who all pulled back and withdrew because you couldn't argue with the inarguable and the indisputable when everyone saw the kind of venom this guy was spewing, and the media covered it, I think, quite well. So, you know, look, here's what I would say, Rabia. I mean, we're fierce advocates for the First Amendment here at the ADL, and we totally recognize and appreciate and respect the fact that our Constitution means that, and the freedoms that we enjoy in this country mean that even people with ideas we don't like, ideas that we might detest, have the right to speak and the right to be heard. There's no doubt about that. But freedom of speech is not the freedom to slander, you know, minorities or individuals. It isn't. And the freedom of expression isn't the freedom to incite violence against someone because of how they pray or where they're from or who they love. And so it's incumbent upon companies to ensure that the terms of service they already have don't just protect the rights of some individual users, but ensure the safety of all of their users.
And we're talking about private companies here. It's not the government. So
no,
there's a lot more leeway for policies that prohibit certain kinds of speech.
Look, if you walk into a restaurant right now, maybe you're not wearing a shirt, maybe you're screaming profanities, right? Maybe you threaten other customers.
Refuse service, right? A restaurant will refuse service.
A restaurant has the right to say, you know what? I don't think I want you to eat here. of course, you can say, you can stand there and say those things, but you should do it outside my restaurant, on the sidewalk, in the park, somewhere else. And Facebook and Google and Twitter and all the companies have the absolute right to do the very same thing.
I will say it's obviously, you know, a complicated issue. And in a perfect world, we would not want to encourage our large media platforms to have, you know, discriminatory viewpoint. But obviously, there it's gone beyond just a question of like, oh, everyone gets to say their piece. This is actual violence being incited.
And that's right. Different. We're not talking about, you know, tough political debates. We're not talking about strong opinions about a piece of art. We're not talking about, you know, really deeply held convictions worked through in like an argument philosophy. We're talking about images and language and memes designed, intended to undermine the legitimacy of a people, to specifically attack individuals, really to denigrate them as something less than human. And we need to have the ability as sophisticated human beings in the 21st century to differentiate between what speech we don't like and what speech we simply can't countenance, you know?
So I've always known the ADL to be kind of, you know, at the forefront of Jewish American civil rights organizing and advocacy. And I'll be honest, for years, I kind of didn't understand the defamation part of it, right? The anti-defamation league. Yeah. And now, I mean, you've used the word slander and you're talking about, you know, denigrating people. And a lot of these memes where, I mean, and some people might argue that, well, they're not rising to violence. They're just suggesting certain things, you know, all these different tropes about Jews. Can you explain kind of the connection of these tropes and kind of even the origin of some of them? Like, for example, you know, I was surprised to know that there's this very longstanding like white supremacist idea that Jews are responsible for like causing immigration havoc in the United States and how that connects to then direct violence.
So white supremacy, this notion of the superiority of white people or the perceived white race, at its core, unfortunately, is this kind of, the whole thing is unfortunate to be clear, but at its core is this root and the seed of anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism predicates on the idea that the Jews are an alien people who typically are manipulating events and scheming and plotting to undermine the majority, in this case, as they define themselves, white people in the United States. These ideas have predicated for thousands of years. These ideas have taken root in some particularly awful, bloody moments in human history. Think the Crusades, when the Crusaders marched from England to the Holy Land and back, you know, butchering and murdering Jewish communities along the way, including those they found in the Middle East. Or think about, of course, the Spanish Inquisition. And unlike this, there was a Spanish Inquisition where Jews were given the opportunity to either convert to Christianity or be murdered. But there were also similar inquisitions in Portugal and other parts of Europe over the course of hundreds of years, pogroms in Russia and Eastern Europe, and of course, the kind of unspeakable tragedy of the Holocaust in Germany. So these patterns have been there for some time. And in all of these cases, the belief is that the Jews are somehow manipulating, plotting, working behind the scenes as an alien, illegitimate people. Okay, so flash forward to now. Modern white supremacists and their ilk believe that a group of Jewish bankers or, you know, look, Jews are accused of being Bolsheviks and Jews are accused of being capitalists, you know, so it runs the gamut, communists and fascists. But in this particular instance, that Jews, Jewish bankers and other Jewish kind of agents are manipulating immigration policy in order to allow migrants and refugees who are Muslim and African and Mexican to invade the United States and commit what they call white genocide, which is to somehow, you know, change the complexion and the identity of the United States, eliminating the white race.
Billionaire tax breaks, polluters writing clean air policies, children being ripped from their families. This is not what democracy is supposed to look like. But that's how it works with Trump and the conservatives controlling the House of Representatives. That's why we have to vote them out and flip the House in the midterms this year. We must elect progressive candidates who will hold Trump and his corrupt administration accountable. So join Swing Left at swingleft.org/45th to find a nearby swing district and take action now. Look, if we flip just 23 districts in the House, we will take back the majority. And that is the best chance we have to put a check on Trump. That means protecting our health care, protecting the rights of everybody, and protecting our democracy. Everybody who really wants to take a stand must do more than vote this year. We need to get fired up, get off the couch, and volunteer. Join Swing Left to find your nearest swing district and take action now. Sign up now at swingleft.org/45th.
I guess I just missed this part of the conspiracy, but why are the Jews trying to do this in this theory?
That is a little harder to get to. I mean, they basically think the Jews hate white people and think the Jews are superior to all other people. And I don't know. It's difficult for me to try to understand the reason, you know, behind the absolutely unreasonable and irrational white supremacists.
So there's not a bigger theory here. It's just a way of expressing anti-Semitism, basically.
It's really just beyond logic. It really is. But I think when in Charlottesville, those marchers, who, by the way, they supposedly were gathering in Charlottesville for a rally to preserve Confederate statues, and yet it sort of unraveled into this melee, and they chanted, "Jews will not replace us." Right. This, again, was a reference to this myth that Jewish powers behind the scenes are plotting to commit white genocide, again, by bringing in people of different nationalities and races. So you saw it on display there, and Heather Heyer was killed. And then you saw it play out this past weekend where 11 elderly people, you know, in a synagogue were gunned down.
You know, Jonathan, I know we're going to wrap up our half hour with you soon. I have a couple of questions that I want you to address before you go. This man murdered 11 people as you're worshiping. And he's been charged with like 29 different felony counts, you know, hate crimes, this and that. Why hasn't he been charged with domestic terrorism? Do you understand that? I mean, like, what's going on there, and why wouldn't this be considered an act of domestic terrorism?
I mean, we absolutely believe the Shavir Guard is a hate crime and is a matter of domestic terrorism. I don't think that these things are necessarily mutually exclusive. You know, Bowers didn't exclaim that these Jews must die, right? He claimed or exclaimed, all Jews must die. He struck at a single house of worship, and, you know, he was trying to instill terror in the broader Jewish community and populace. And that's terrorism, regardless of whether or not
he's
an organized group, you know, whether he's a member of the KKK or Al-Qaeda or anything else. When you seek to terrorize, not just to harm an individual because of his or her, again, a religion or national origin or sexual orientation, but rather to instill terror in an entire population, that's terrorism.
Unquestionably. I mean, there's just not even room for debate about it.
Most importantly, right now, what can the rest of us do? How can we, our listeners and just people in general who are horrified by this, and understand that this is anti-Semitism, but this is also about our country and what's happening to it. How can we support the Jewish community this time? How do we fight this hate? How do we hold leaders accountable? And we didn't get a chance to actually talk about that. And I wanted to talk about that. Susan and I will probably rant about that for a bit. And maybe it's best I don't put you in that political corner. But what is the best thing for people? I mean, obviously, voting, getting involved. But sure. I don't know to what extent that can eliminate, like, the core of this issue, which is white supremacy and anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, you know, I think people should be voting anyways, but that's not going to eliminate this problem specifically. Number one, I think... Right. People should interrupt hate when it happens. So there's a cascading effect and things can metastasize. So when you hear an ugly comment, when you hear you know, a bigoted remark, whether it's at the water cooler at work or it's on the playing field or at school or it's over, the dinner table at home. I think all of us, it's incumbent on all of us. We have an obligation to say we have a zero tolerance policy on intolerance. So that's number one. I think number two, I think particularly for me, you know, Rabia, one of the things that has come out of this that, you know, at least I've noted, and I feel grateful to be in dialogue with you and with other members of the Muslim community and different Christian denominations and the Sikh community, et cetera, is we need to build bridges. And seeing the interfaith vigil or memorial service that was held on Sunday night in Pittsburgh was incredibly powerful. So show up for another community, one that's not your own. And whether it's this week, you know, some of the interfaith vigils, I know ADL has been involved in over 40 interfaith vigils and memorial services around the country. I've got 25 offices, so we're very involved. But there are lots of ways, large and small, I think you can reach out. And this is really what we ultimately need. In order to defeat hate, in order to fight for the diversity and the equity that's always made this country great, it's not ultimately about, in my opinion, building walls. It's actually about locking arms. It's about finding ways to connect with other people and create common ground. And that's not always easy because we're trapped in our filter bubbles of social media and we retreat to our different ideological corners. And I get that impulse. But now more than ever, people need to kind of dig deeper and really reach higher. And so that's what I would say.
Well, nothing good comes easy. So thank you for that. Lastly, before you head out, how can people find you online and learn more about the ADL?
That's a great question. Well, you can find us online at adl.org, adl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. And we're grateful for the support. We're grateful for the support.
Great. Thank you so much. And guys, you can also find Jonathan himself on Twitter, not just the ADL. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Lots of prayers for your community and support for all the work you're doing. Tough times. And we are here in solidarity with you. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Appreciate it.
So if you follow me and Robbie on Twitter, you probably know that we love our cats a little bit too much, maybe. No, that's not true.
It's not normal to have social media accounts for your cats. Is that what you're trying to say?
Susan? And to like only post pictures of your cats. It's probably not normal, right. But I'm okay with it. Anyway, our cats are amazing. We have Mr. Beans and Gringo on Robbie's side. And then we got Ragnarok and Ghost on my side. Mm-hmm. And they're all assholes.
They're all assholes. But you know what? They're assholes with needs that we need to meet. One of the most important needs is getting them good litter. My issue is this. You know, I will do anything for my cats. I hate changing the litter box. It's the one thing that I will do anything in this house, but I will not clean the litter box until now, because now we have pretty litter and it's changed the litter box game.
Pretty litter is kitty litter 2.0. It's shipped right to our doors in small lightweight bags and it lasts the entire month.
Yeah. Not only is it manageable because I cannot haul those huge boxes of cat litter and bags of it, but also what I love about it is, you know what? You finally have cat litter that doesn't smell awful. I cannot deal with the ammonia pee-pee smell of cat litter. And ever since we started using Pretty Litter, it's gone. It really is gone.
And the best part of Pretty Litter is that it monitors your cat's health. Pretty Litter changes colors to detect underlying illnesses before urgent medical care is needed, saving you money, stress, and potentially your cat's life.
That's pretty amazing. So you can watch the crystals, because there's these crystals, and these crystals not only are the super absorbent crystals that like trap and conceal the odor I was talking about and the moisture, but also the same crystals will change color, which is crazy. And my 10-year-old is like always like hovering to see to make sure the cat's doing okay now.
Luckily, anyway, I've not seen a change in color yet, but
same here. So do what we did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and using our promo code 45th for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code 45th for 20% off. Don't miss out. Prettylitter.com, promo code 45th. All right. So once again, we are really thankful to Jonathan Greenblatt for joining us, especially in a time when I know he's slammed with media requests and just responding to community needs. But, you know, there's a lot more that I also wanted to discuss relative to this tragedy, but, you know, providing kind of a broader context, especially politically, because, you know, that's what Susan and I do. Jonathan, we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but Susan and I are going to go there. So let's start it on this.
So Rabia, we talked yesterday, yeah. But did you get a chance to look at that closing ad from Trump for the 2016 election?
Oh, no, I did not. I know you mentioned it to me and I didn't get a chance. But why don't you fill our listeners in about what that last ad was for him?
For those of you who've blocked out your memory, it was an ad that featured a bunch of like prominent Jewish figures in menacing light and standing there representing a threat to American interest. Now, there's no explicit reference to it, but it was a bit too much to be just a coincidence.
All Jews.
Yeah. And yeah, it was, I forget who it was, like Janet Yellen and a few others. And then, of course, you have much more recently, a few days ago, Trump tweeting about Soros.
Right, right. And he's been retweeting accounts as well. So, I mean, and then I think in a rally the other day, he again alluded to like globalists. He's like, they call themselves global. I mean, and I refuse to believe he doesn't know what he's saying. He knows exactly what he's saying. Globalists is literally like, that is like, you know, code switching for Jews who control the world type of stuff.
You know, I guess it's not that it typically, not that it matters because he's the president and his actions have the same consequences, but I'm not convinced this is coming from an actual place of anti-Semitism within him. He's using it politically. He's acting in that manner intentionally. But as far as I'm aware, I mean,
Susan, do you really think a man who is like a bigot to everybody else and misogynist and a crook and like that's the line he's not going to cross?
No, I think it's not going to cross. It's just like he, as far as I'm aware in his life until running for election, he never had any history of that. I mean, he's certainly okay, not refused maybe. To do business with Jewish people. He's certainly not. Like, this is a new thing for him in terms of the outrightness of it.
Right. I mean, I do remember there was like that. I mean, I guess, I don't know, decades ago, he had said something about how he didn't want any black accountants. He wanted like the Jews handling his money.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
not funny. I shouldn't be laughing. But
that's got, you know, kind of a, I mean, that is also anti-Semitic.
That is true.
I mean, it is.
I phrase it wrong. I will say it's his desire to like.
Yeah, and anti-black. I mean, but as Jonathan said, those kinds of things do hurt Jews. I mean, like it is about stereotypes. It's about, I mean, those things lead to, but Trump is not, I mean, you talk about Soros, Trump is not backing down on the idea that Jews are somehow responsible for this, for an invasion of immigrants. Right. I mean, like, so I wanted to talk about like the tweets just in the last few days, on October 16th. Well, I guess not a few days, but, you know, in the last couple of weeks, Trump tweeted, the U.S. has strongly informed the president of Honduras that the large caravan of people heading to the U.S. is not stopped and brought back to Honduras. No more money or aid will be given, blah, blah, blah. And then he tweeted again about, I mean, the same thing. And then the vice president tweeted about the migrant caravan and talking to the president of Honduras. And they've repeatedly, like the GOP talking heads have repeately, not just talking heads, but alt-right people are connecting this caravan immigrant invasion, just like Jonathan said, to Jewish Americans and Jewish globalists. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what motivated this guy. I mean, he specifically cited Hias, right? Like the Hebrew immigrant aid society, and saying we got to stop the Jews because the Jews are also responsible for the immigrant invasion.
Yeah. And it's absolute, like, I mean, there in a normal world, there is an important and nuanced debate to be had there about drawing direct parallels between leaders' actions and actions of people like this. This is not that nuanced, careful world we used to live in. The president is outright, I was going to say spouting, but tweeting this rhetoric that inspired this guy. Who, by the way, apparently thought that Trump was just not nearly racist enough.
Right.
Racist.
That was his beef.
Yeah.
That was his beef with Trump.
He knew he called him racist, but not racist enough. But Rabia, yeah. I think you missed this morning's tweets. So we're recording late due to logistics issues, but you missed what this tangent he went off this morning.
Vomiting baby issues is why we're recording late. But anyway, no idea what happened this morning. Tell me.
So this one's awful. The caravans are made up of some very tough fighters and people, fought back hard and viciously against Mexico at northern border before breaking through. Mexican soldiers hurt, were unable, or unwilling to stop caravan. Should stop them before they reach our border, but won't.
This is, you know, it's like
it's fascism.
Crazy talk.
It's fascism. It's straight up fascism, and it's coming to America. It's been here for a while, but like, it's just gaining steam. It's not slowing down.
Well, I mean, I saw the announcement like yesterday. Was it yesterday or the day before? I can't remember because every day is hell. We're sending 17,000 troops to the border
for like maybe 2,000 people in the caravans.
Half of them are like more than half are women and children. What he is?
It's all theater.
It's all theater. He's doing this on purpose. But you know what he's doing? He's frightening the crap out of people who might already be mentally unstable, right? Like this guy, like Bowers. He's doing it to rile up his base because the midterms are coming. But he is basically going to incite violence. That's what he's going to do.
Yeah. So I guess there is one possible flip side of it, is that in recent days for polling, it seems like there has been a noticeable uptick in voter enthusiasm from Latino voters, which is, if real, and it's like early polling from what I've seen. I mean, it's a sign that as much as Trump believes in the throwing red meat to the base theory of politics, it has consequences. It's not a solid win for him to keep doing this. It will motivate people who are terrified by what he's doing, I hope.
Right. I mean, that's the hope. But having said that, he also lost the election by popular vote, and he's still president, and so
I've been like this. And then we have freaking Sarah Sanders at the one press conference in like almost a month up there saying that Trump won by an overwhelming majority.
Yeah, wow. That's insane. I mean, you know what? Because her audience is him. I mean, like, this is... It's like the Truman Show. That's what this is. I mean, like, it's all theater for him to make, because he's watching her and he needs his soldiers to lie for him. The guy's deranged.
You can't fact check your way out of fascism.
Yeah.
And then 2 years.
The response to this shooting, the very first response to this shooting from him was that, oh, the synagogue should have had like armed guards, or they should have people with guns. That was his very first response. And then he goes on that night to a rally, the same night 11 people have been murdered, and says, I almost canceled coming, not because this huge act of terrorism, but because I had a bad hair day. Did you catch that?
I did later on. I thought it was actually fake, because I was out of town. A couple times now I've just been not online when these shootings happen. And when you come back and see that it's like, you know, it's been 12, 24 hours, and watching all the aftermath is so unreal. And like, again, we've just been that whole time. Like, I wasn't gone that long. We've gone through it again.
Right.
And then I saw that, and I thought that was totally a joke. And then, of course, it was not.
Yeah.
And then I found out that Trump couldn't go through, didn't know how to use umbrellas, which turned out to be real. And I was kind of okay with that.
You know, I watched that kind of numb. And it was in the middle of that video of him, like, walking up Air Force steps to Air Force One, and he has an umbrella. He doesn't even know how to hold an umbrella properly. It's so awkward. And then he just leaves it outside the door. And although ordinarily I would have shared it and thought ridiculous funny, it was just too horrible a day to even care. I mean, screw him. And, he's just a ball of pus. Can't use an umbrella. And so beyond that, I don't know what other response. I know that him and Melania apparently visited Pittsburgh.
But his response was to blame the media.
There is that. That's true. I forgot about that.
So to make this a very stark divide, we know exactly how Trump responds when there is a mass act of terrorism and the perpetrator is brown. That's the call for their execution. When there's an act of terrorism and the perpetrator is white, he starts attacking the media for being mean to him. It's blatant and like repeatable, like every single time. It's the same damn thing.
I loved your tweet, by the way, where you said every time he says fake news, he means free press.
He does.
That's so spot on. That is so spot on. That's how I'm going to read it every time now. Now, you know, all of this happened and we never really got a chance to talk about the other terrorist from right before all this happened. The other white guy with a white van covered in Trump stickers. And wow, the conspiracy theory is coming out of the right. So the weather has been turning in the last couple of weeks, and if there's one go-to when it starts getting like this, it is my Bombas socks. I know you have Bombas socks too, Susan, right?
I got them on right now.
You got them on right now?
Yeah.
I don't have mine on right now. I'm feeling a little chilly, so I'm going to grab some soon, but there's not a single day that I don't wear my Bombas socks, either because I want to feel cozy or because I'm going to the gym. I love wearing them to work out.
I love the summer, and I'm not happy it's getting cold now, but the good side, I can wear comfy socks all the time.
Well, these are the comfiest socks. First of all, they've got this amazing arch support system. It provides extra support right under your arch, especially, like I said, when you're working out. You've got a cushioned footbed. It's reinforced for comfort. There's no added bulkiness because it feels awful, actually. Whether you're just wearing them around the house or whether you're wearing them to work out or whatever.
There's some socks that you can wear, like, alone, and they're comfy, and some you wear shoes are comfy. this is like the one magical unicorn sock that you can wear alone and comfy, and you put them in a shoe and they're not all bulky and stuff.
Yes, they are transition socks. They can just go anywhere. And they've got the stay-up technology, which I love. 133 tension levels were tested. I mean, talk about, you know, being perfectionist, but that's what Bombas did. They tested 133 tension levels to find the perfect tension that's comfortable so your sock doesn't droop, but also it doesn't create like that grip of death around your ankle that leaves a mark.
I feel like tension level is like missing what it actually is here. It's the sock that actually stays on your foot.
Right. Basically, that's what we're trying to say. It stays on your foot. And one of the things I actually love most about Bombas socks, because I mean, in the spirit of just generosity, is that for every single pair they sell, they donate a pair. That's a big deal. Socks are the number one most requested item at homeless shelters. My husband has been running a homeless shelter service for like 6 years. And I know every time it starts getting cold, that's what people need. But you can't really donate used socks. And so Bombas donates one brand new pair of socks for every single pair that they sell. So when you buy a pair of socks, someone else is getting a pair of socks.
And now 45th listeners can get 20% off their first order. Go to bombas.com/45th. That's BOMBAS.com. And you'll get 20% off your first order. Bombas.com/45th and code 45th. I saw something you tweeted and that was it. I was like, wait, I'm so confused right now. That
right.
Lady.
So this, I mean, clearly this guy is deeply unhinged. And my concern is for people who are already like,
yes, unhinged, but like, I don't think I want to slap the label of crazy on these people yet. Cause we don't know, one, like, are they actually mentally ill? Or two, are they just people who are prone to like hyper political leanings that are now like on overdrive?
That could be it. I guess for me, anytime I see a van covered in any kind of sticker, I don't care if they're about Jesus. I don't care what they're about. Like, something to me is off. I get it. A couple of stickers on your station wagon makes sense.
But it was more than that. I only like saw close-ups not too long ago, and they had, they're people with targets. They're like Democratic politicians with targets on their faces.
Right.
How is that not reported sooner? That actually is an outright threat on his van. It's not just stickers, not just a bunch of MAGA stuff everywhere. It was threats of violence against people on his van.
I mean, could somebody be arrested for that? I mean, didn't Sarah Palin at some point have like some...
Not arrested, but checked out, and checking him out probably would have quickly made someone realize that something was wrong here. I feel like the system definitely screwed up here and should have caught this.
Yeah. Well, thank God nobody got hurt. And they did catch him before somebody got hurt, because he sent out, I don't know, like a dozen different bombs. I mean, it's amazing to me that nobody got killed. Amazing. Having sent out that many explosive devices, which, by the way, I heard I can't remember who it was, but some security official, I can't remember, some intelligence official saying that they were actually IEDs. I mean, like, so there weren't even like, it wasn't even like they were fake. They were actually real explosive devices.
Why didn't they go off? Do you know?
That I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I mean, like, then this happened right, like the very next day this shooting happened. I think the day after this guy's arrest. And so it's just been, it's just been one thing after another. So, but that's a good question. I don't know why, but you know, in the wake of that, basically Trump and all his, you know, they started floating false flag, theories that this is a Democratic setup, and by the way, saying, of course it's a setup. That's how come nobody actually died. It was all like faked.
Or possibly the guy with all the stickers on his van was not the best bomb maker.
There's that. And also there was, I saw this conspiracy theory that the stickers were way too new looking. Like, this was just, the whole thing was contrived, and it's not really a guy who's a MAGA guy with a bunch of stickers. Like, it's just, they're too clean and shiny.
How old are these stickers going to be?
That's the
next 2 years.
They're not going to be around that long anyways. All right. So yesterday, this is how the day began, is the Axios news that Trump gave an interview in which he said he is going to sign an executive order ending birthright citizenship, 14th Amendment, repeal it. Can't do it, right? Please?
Well, no? Okay. First of all, this is how journalists are just...
complicit in this shit.
Not even complicit. I won't call it complicit. Exploiting and being co-opted by this burgeoning fascist movement. Axios, New York Times, probably the worst about it. They have a tendency to ask Trump things trying to bait them into these quotes, which is not harmless and not like it, that comes with a cost. Right. I mean, yes, he's going to say crazy shit sometimes and you have to cover when he does, but don't, for God's sake, bait him into it like this. He just gets like, it worked out perfectly for him. This was not even a plan. This was just, he would ask me a comment. He did. He got the attention he wanted. And that's not to say it's harm. Like, it's not to say that it's not an issue now, because it is an issue now. And when Trump says crazy stuff, sometimes he does follow through on it. Oh, so yeah, Axios, New York Times, stop that shit.
I mean, he could issue the executive order. I guess the executive order would, what impact would that have? I'm thinking the only impact that would have is, I don't know.
So here's what would happen. It would get, there'd be instant litigation. It would probably be a stay. I think it would be a stay on it, unless the courts are really screwed up. It goes to the Supreme Court and they'd rule on it. And then it'd either go into effect or wouldn't.
I mean, I'm trying to think realistically. You know what that would require? That would require hospitals and counties. When somebody is giving birth, to be like, we need to know your immigration status, the parent's immigration status, in order to issue a birth certificate for this child.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to, is whether or not that child gets a U.S. a birth certificate, or because if they get a U.S. birth certificate, then that's it. Like, then that is the basis for a U.S. passport. Or is it going to be at the next, like, I don't even understand, like, how this is supposed to look and what he expects. I imagine the chaos, right? Imagine the chaos.
It wouldn't go into instant effect. It would definitely take at least, minimum 6 months to go to the Supreme Court. So by that time, they'd have a plan together. And, this current court could actually go for it. It's insane and it's not constitutional, but it could be constitutional before too long, given what we have right now.
So they would have to actually change the constitutional requirement.
It wouldn't be constitutional. It wouldn't. They would declare actually it's not constitutional. It was never constitutional. In fact, all along, we've gotten that part of the Constitution wrong. Originally, it meant something else, and we've now discovered what it meant, because we're originalist.
It was only meant for the descendants of slaves, right? Something like that.
But that's not what it says, and that's not right. What the text has in it. And, in a normal universe, again, this would never, like, this wouldn't be an issue. But his court, it's going to be possible.
Even if it's an originalist issue, I'm talking about the constitutional mechanism to repeal an amendment.
It's not like repealing it. So what they'd be doing is saying, actually, that part of the Constitution has never said what we thought it said all along. It says something entirely different. And in fact, you can regulate. It'd be like, oh, constitutionally, if both your parents are Americans, you're born on American soil, then you can't possibly be excluded from being an American. But everyone else, yeah.
Oh, I see. So basically, let the amendment stand. The amendment just doesn't apply to the children of immigrants.
It doesn't apply to whatever they, like, whatever. The originalists will decide what
Susan,
originally what.
They could take away my citizenship.
Yeah.
Because that's how it happened. I mean, that's how I got it.
Well, you didn't get birthright citizenship, right? Yeah, no, you weren't born here.
No, but I am an immigrant. And so that could impact my children's citizenship.
Yes.
Then. My children who are born here.
Your children are have parents that are two immigrants. So yes, your children could be impacted seriously. I would suspect they would never allow it to be retroactive. Even this court, as insane as it is, I would like to think that is the bridge too far. And the fact that's what we're calling the bridge too far is itself a sign of insanity. Because right. The mere possibility of this executive order, quote unquote,
I want everybody to rest assured the other immigrant parent of my children is Canadian. So worst comes to worst, you'll find me in Toronto. But oh my God, I'm laughing. But this is unreal. It's unreal. I didn't think about that. You're right, that the Supreme Court could interpret it in a way that doesn't require any repealing of an amendment. And I'm assuming Trump has been briefed on that possibility, which is why he said, oh, it turns out I don't need to do it. I could just do an executive order. He'll test it because it doesn't. What does it take from him? It's just like a signing ceremony. He'll do it.
He loves signing ceremonies.
He loves it. And his base is going to love it. They'll do it.
Even if they lose, they'll love it.
The thing is, none of it's going to matter. None of it can happen fast enough to impact like the midterm elections, I don't think.
Well, it's impacting it right now because that's how he gets the base motivated, his racism.
No, I mean in terms of like taking away the right of people to vote.
No,
children to vote, right? Like my eldest can vote. Like that he couldn't do that.
I would like to believe that whatever tatters of rule of law we have are still strong enough where they would not retroactively revoke citizenship. It'd be a going forward basis kind of thing. But who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? Okay.
I mean, okay, just to point out too, this is not just an American thing. If we needed more of a sign, this is a worldwide crisis. We have Brazil.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we have Brazil. Let's talk a little bit about this new president in Brazil. What's his name?
Jair Bolsonaro.
Yeah, so he is a complete right-wing nut.
He's an outright fascist.
He is an outright fascist, yeah. He's horrible. And apparently, like, literally since the day he was elected, like, the very next day, he ordered law enforcement and military to raid universities over there, to basically anything that talks about fascism, any kind of lectures, any kind of talks, any kind of curriculum, anything like that's been stripped of it. They're no longer, I mean, it's like immediately. I mean, there's no greater sign you're a fascist than the first thing you're going to go after is any kind of educational material cautioning against fascism. But what do you know about his history, basically?
I know that he was considered such a ludicrous figure that he got media attention and was put on TV to display just how ludicrous he was.
Oh, Jesus. That sounds familiar.
Backfired.
It backfired. He has said some really despicable things, and they're not coming to mind right now, but I've read them and been horrified. I remember this was actually before the election. I was like, he can't be elected. I mean, stuff that was, I think,
he's
even
a racist,
much more,
he's a bigot, he's
much
anti-LGBT, he's every bad thing that Trump aspires to be.
Oh, he had said that he had told a woman, I wouldn't rape you because you're not, like, rape worthy.
That's what Trump said, basically.
Right. That's true, too. You're right. And I think Trump congratulated him in a tweet.
Trump was very excited that he has now another fascist on the bench. I mean, look who Trump's been friends with. Like, China now we're having economic disputes with, but he admires the Chinese style of leadership. He admires the North Korean style of leadership. He admires
Duarte,
now Brazil. Yeah.
Philippines. Yep. Those are his people. MBS, Saudi. I'm sure Trump is like, man, I wish I could kill and dismember every journalist I wanted. This story unfolded yesterday afternoon, and I was like, what is happening? The Mueller stuff. Have you been following it?
Oh, you're talking about the Walsh, right?
The Jacob Wall and
Wall.
So apparently there was a conspiracy to, oh my God. Well, like, how stupid do you have to be like, I'm going to frame Robert Mueller of all people?
I resisted getting too far into this because it was so ridiculous and so absurd. Like, you know what? It doesn't actually matter. I don't need to know every detail of this conspiracy, but I kind of do.
So there was apparently a scheme. Like, and Jacob Wall, he's like this 20-something-year-old idiotic right-wing activist.
No, he's just a grifter. Straight up grifter.
He apparently was just totally openly contacting women and saying, we'll pay you this much money if you make an accusation of sexual impropriety against Robert Mueller. And then him and others began contacting the people scheming with him, began contacting journalists saying, ooh, a story's going to come out. Look out for it. Some of these journalists referred it to the FBI because I don't know why. I thought that was interesting. I'm not sure how that happened.
Oh, you missed the fact that actually it was a fake person too. The first one to come forward was probably Jacob Wall himself.
Okay.
He made a fake person that was going around trying to claim, oh, look, I'm being paid to do this stuff. Apparently, in an effort to discredit claims later on that these women are paid by having, like, it backfire in the journalist's face or something. They report that, oh, women are being paid. Oh, look, she doesn't really exist. Oh, look, these other women claim to have stories of sexual assault. They couldn't have been paid because that story was already done and proven wrong. I don't even know. It's peak 2018.
Well, it's been referred to the FBI, whether or not, I don't know if they've actually opened an investigation into it, but here's my question. Is this criminal behavior?
Yes.
That's what I thought. Cause I saw somebody tweet, why are we talking about this? So what? It was a stupid conspiracy, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure that this goes beyond just like a stupid scheme.
To be fair, we don't know what all the stupid scheme involved. So theoretically it could have been done in a way that's not yet criminal, but come on, it's Jacob Wall. He's going to start like destroying evidence and deleting emails, and then he's committed a crime. So the crime is in progress. If it has not been committed already, there is a crime in progress. And he's already done crimes. He's already been banned from financial work.
Right.
The worst part of this whole story is guess who first reported him?
Oh, yeah. The Hill guy.
No. The Krasenstein brothers. One, I don't even know who. One of them. This is like, again, the peakest peak 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there is no honor among grifters. They're both going to just turn on each other.
I mean, look, you got to protect. I mean, like, I mean, maybe even, you know, for them, it was, or him, that guy, Krasenstein, whatever his name was, like, is like, this is one grift too far.
Well, no, game undermines game, I guess. I mean, the Krasensteins are basically the less version of Jake Wall.
Yeah. And Jacob and his father and this guy, Jack Berman, right? He's a GOP activist. And Jack Berman is definitely somehow in the mix because he's been tweeting, you know, saying that there's going to be a story coming out. He's been dropping hints that he knows something's happening. And they continue to tweet. And I'm like, this is really bad. I mean, considering you might want to stop saying stuff like at this point publicly.
Stop criming. Yeah, this is not
right. Stop criming.
And the best part is they're going to have, I don't like tomorrow or something. I don't even know, but they're going to have a big announcement about Robert Mueller's like sexual assault history at the like the Rosalind Holiday Inn.
Oh, really?
That's like the saddest venue you could possibly have imagined for this.
It is. Yeah. It's not a bad Holiday Inn. I've been there. I've been to a wedding there. Show up for it. Yeah. Good luck with that. That's probably where they're going to get arrested. That'd be great. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Well,
any other tweets this morning that I missed? I know you read that one.
Oh, there are like three more just like that one. I spared you the rest, but there were plenty of these just blatantly false claims about the caravan, which, you know, that's what his base wants. His base wants racism. His base wants him to attack immigrants. And that's all he knows how to do. Like, that's his only trick right now. And he's going to keep on playing it.
Well,
We have a new tweet.
Okay.
Oh, wow. This tweet is it's one of his like multi-part tweets. But he's not done the part two yet.
Okay.
And it's been 26 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody took the phone away. I don't know.
Must have. So we got a so-called birthright citizenship, which cost our country billions of dollars and is very unfair to our citizens, will be ended one way or the other. It is not covered by the 14th Amendment because of the words subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Many legal scholars agree, ..
Okay. You know what? Stephen Miller tweeted that shit. I don't think Donald Trump could string those sentences together. But yeah, this is now a thing. This is going to be a thing. I am.
Damn you, Axios. Stop your stupid bullshit reporting.
I am. I'm pretty shook. I mean, like, I don't understand. Like, basically, the only thing that can stop this is taking the House and the Senate. I mean, both.
One of them. One or the other.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to win the Senate. Basically, it is all riding on getting the House back.
Yeah, but the House can only, I mean, you need the Senate to impeach this guy. You can't.
Oh, impeaching's not going to happen. We just need a check at this point to stop whatever he's doing. Or not whatever, just to give some kind of block to what he's doing and to have some kind of check on investigations and to stop them from firing Mueller, which they will if they don't win and probably if they win anyway. So in other Trump corruption news, which has gone under the radar because now corruption's openly accepted. We've reached the point in America where corruption itself is not newsworthy, so it doesn't get covered.
Right.
But Ryan Zinke has been referred to the DOJ for investigation.
I saw something about that, but I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we know which one has been referred yet. We know that Interior Secretary Zinke has been under internal investigation by his Solicitor General, the guy inside the DOI who spoke.
OIG.
Yeah, that's the one. Too many acronyms. But the guy who's supposed to look over Zinke inside was doing that. Had a bunch of things going on. And of course, what does Zinke do? He fires the guy. But now, one of those investigations, I don't know if we know which one yet, has been referred to the DOJ for potential criminal investigation.
Okay.
So that at least is still happening.
That's good.
I swear to God, the Trump administration wished in the monkey's paw. And now they have very few white collar prosecutions, but the ones that happen are all against Trump people.
Oh, wow. All right. Okay. Well, I don't know.
So
one of the worst weeks ever, maybe.
Rabia, this is our last episode before the midterms.
It is.
I think we'll do a delayed episode next week, record on Tuesday or Wednesday. So
that's an excellent idea. Let's aim for that. And then we'll see how the future feels.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Susan.
So
and thank
everyone,
you guys.
Get out there and vote.
Get out there and vote.
Do
yeah.
it for me. I'm a DC resident. My vote means shit. So
do it for my children.
Yes. Do it for me and Robbie's children.
Otherwise, I'm going to eat poutine for the rest of my life. All right, guys. We'll be back in a week.
Bye.
Thanks so much.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.